Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. In today's program, we hear of the way in which some women who regret that they had had an abortion have found forgiveness and the ability to forgive those who caused them pain. We also hear more from those who are captured in Africa and sold into slavery in America. Benedictines have a special vocation to a life in community. Abbot Edmund Power now explains further.
If I live alone, whose feet will I wash?
St. Basil the Great, the father of Eastern monasticism, wrote that if they had to be compared, the life of a monk in community was better than that of a solitary hermit. After all, the gospel is about the service of others. Abbot Edmund Power, abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls in Rome, adds,
Basil's very interesting because he compares or contrasts the eremitical life, the life of the hermit, with the cenobitical life, the life in community, and says that the cenobitical is more important or greater, which might surprise us somewhat because we might think that a solitary battle alone with the in the desert is greater than just living in community. But Basil makes the very telling comment, if I live alone, whose feet will I wash?
Benedict agreed that the life of a hermit dedicated to God is good and holy, but the monk must first prove that he is able to live in community.
Benedict writes for cenobites, for community monks, but he does acknowledge that some might be called to the eremitical life, but he sees it as rare, and it comes after years of training in community, when a person has reached a level of selflessness or of a purity of life whereby they can live alone.
Yes, because it can be a great escapism to be a hermit.
It's very tempting, you know, I find sometimes that as an abbot you've got all the problems of your community coming at you day and night, which is fine, but sometimes I sit back and think to myself, I wish he'd called me to be a hermit.
But, you know, I remember before I entered, my headmistress, who was a sister of Notre Dame, telling me that the hardest lesson I would have to learn as a religious would be to live in community. Mm-hmm. And at the time I thought she was talking a load of rubbish. I wrote her a few years ago and said, you know, you were right after all.
Yeah, it's not all it's not all fun.
We are all called to live together, but a religious community is one with a difference.
We know living in community is the normal condition of most of the human race, whether it's the community of the family or the local village or area of the city or parish or whatever. But living in religious community is a particular way of living, you know, the pooling of everything, you know, the shared search for God which underlies everything, or the service of others. It's a very particular way of living community life, living in community, but a very rich way.
Benedictines add an extra dimension to community living by means of their vows.
The concept of three vows or four vows, which canon law has developed later, in fact, is a later development. In Benedict's rule, the monastic commitment is seen as a single commitment, a single profession, but explained in different ways, and so you can glean from what he says the three traditional Benedictine vows, which are conversion of life, and we usually retain the Latin conversatio morum because it's not exactly clear what it means. It covers the whole range of monastic asceticism. Then obedience, and then stability. And for us, stability, well, it's got several layers of meaning. It's a very rich concept. The obvious meaning is that you remain a member of the community in which you make your profession for the rest of your life. Now, seeing that Benedictine monasteries are fairly stable institutions, often located in one area, and often have there for many years, like the community of St. Paul's, 1,300 years in the same place, you know, that's a stability of place. But it also has the sense of stability, of fidelity to the spiritual search. In other words, a fundamental firmness in this search for God. Now, it can also have meanings at the personal level, you know, fidelity to your relationships within community. Stability can mean that you are always there, reliable for your brothers or sisters in community. So it's quite a rich concept.
Mary, at the foot of the cross, offers a model to Benedictines with their vow of stability.
It could be related, for example, to the stance of Mary at the foot of the cross, you know, Stabat Mater Dolorosa, Stabat, this idea of standing firm in the face of persecution and suffering. The word standing is related to the word stability, and this idea of standing firm, even though life has its sufferings and difficulties, is part of the monastic concept of stability. So it's quite a rich idea, really.
Magnificat anima mea Dominum, et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo salutari meum.
Benedictines are traditionally associated with prayer in common, especially the Divine Office, which is sung. Abbot Edmund refers to his own monastery at St. Paul's outside the walls, which maintains an ancient custom.
We have different patterns of prayer together, and the most obvious one is the Divine Office. Benedict in the Rule talks quite a lot about the Divine Office and how it should be conducted. Normally, according to his vision, the monks of the community would sing or recite the whole Psalter, all 150 psalms, in a week. The Roman Office now divides into 4 weeks, but we still do that. In fact, at St. Paul's, we recite the whole Psalter in a week. It means that it's quite a lot of time in the Divine Office. We're in office, I think, 4 or 5 times a day. That's one thing, and that might take, few hours, several hours a day.
But there is also time and space for silent prayer and reflection upon the message of Scripture.
And then we have the Lectio Divina, or a spiritual reading of Scripture, which will take other time, but usually it's a private, you do it alone, you do a Lectio Divina alone.
Magnificat anima mea Domine. Et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo salutari meum.
Over the years, the Benedictines have become particularly linked with Gregorian chant, a tradition which Abbot Edmund and the community at St. Paul's outside the walls continues.
A tradition of music has developed. We talk about Gregorian chant, and it's traditionally associated with Gregory the Great, who died about the year 610. But in fact, Benedict predates Gregory the Great. They must have sung something. I don't know what they sung in Benedict's monastery, but it can't have been Gregorian chant, because Gregory was only born the year of Benedict's death. But a tradition of chanting has been developed, and the whole richness of the Gregorian repertoire, which the monasteries have traditionally preserved, although nowadays a lot of monasteries we also sing modern music and new psalm tones, but often Gregorian chant and the scholarship of Gregorian chant has been associated with Benedictines, for example the Abbey of Solesmes in France. And we, at St. Paul's, for example, we retain the Gregorian. We have our antiphons and hymns in Latin, traditional Latin. We use the Roman gradual for the chants of the Mass. And we sing the psalms in Italian. fortunately, the psalms in Italian go rather well to Gregorian melodies. It's much harder, or considerably harder, singing English psalms to Gregorian melodies. So that's an advantage of operating in Italian.
Woman might find herself under intense pressure to have an abortion, but once the baby is gone, there is no turning back the clock. Some women fear that they will never find forgiveness for their action, whereas others find it hard to forgive. Yet, there is hope for them all.
The reasons women have abortions are out of fear and out of coercion.
If the cause of an abortion is fear, then in order to bring about healing, there must be the freedom from fear, the freedom to forgive and be forgiven, and the freedom to trust. Vicky Thorne founded the organisation Project Rachel with the intention of enabling women who have had one or more abortions to make their peace with God, with themselves, and with the baby whose life was lost as a result of the abortion.
And that someone's forcing them. They've been told, if you ever come home pregnant, we'll throw you out. The boyfriend says, I'll leave you. So there's this incredible fear that drives her. It's not necessarily linked to this other question, but in her own spiritual maturity as it comes, she needs to be forgiven.
And there are some incredible stories, aren't there?
Oh, the stories are just amazing. And I have a friend who had 5 abortions before she was 20. She came out of a cultural tradition where she should have been Catholic, but she was Protestant. And she said she was overwhelmed with this knowledge of healing when she needed to do it. And she was looking at some of the Protestant models, but they don't have a sacramental model. And so Bible studies, very thick. And she said to God, I have 5 abortions. I am never going to be healed. And God led her to Project Rachel in her city. And she came into the church. And there are many women who come into the church through this because Project Rachel is open to anyone. We're very respectful of their faith tradition. So if they're Lutheran, well, we'll try and find a Lutheran pastor for you to work with. But so many women have made the journey then into the church because the church was right on abortion and then we were right on contraception. And they, you know, they make the rest of the journey into the church. It's very amazing.
Well, I know of a Ghanaian woman who became pregnant as a result of rape. And she was helped to keep her baby. So she didn't have that sort of anger to deal with, but she certainly had the anger against the rapist. And she kept the baby, and she'd been helped to such an extent, she called the baby forgiveness.
Did she really? Isn't that lovely? We have a very good friend who was the product of rape in Germany and migrated to the United States. And we've often talked about that. He's a son. And the courage he thought his mother had to be able to forgive and to keep him and to celebrate the life that came under these awful circumstances. Women who have been raped and have abortions often describe the abortion as another rape, that it complicates that in terms of the, you know, the experience of it. And if we do, if we choose abortion under those circumstances, what do we do to the rapist? Because the child's the other victim in that piece. But there are just some truly miraculous stories when we're able to see with the eyes of faith. People say, oh, you must be depressed. You know, you hear so many hard stories. And I'm like, no, because I know God heals people. No one's ever called and said, it didn't work. But it's important that when women begin their healing journey, that they say a little prayer and give God permission to heal them. because they feel so unworthy that they keep the door closed. Why won't God heal me? Where is God? But they wouldn't say to God, okay, heal me. But it's an important piece to say a little prayer that says, you know, God, I give you permission to heal me.
. 2007 is the bicentenary of Britain's law abolishing slavery. From 1807, any slave that landed on English soil was automatically free. Yet, although few slaves set foot on British shores, the products of slave labour were all too common and were, in fact, even necessary for the survival of people who, although legally free, were yet entrapped by poverty and the Industrial Revolution. How was it that free and independent Africans ended up in the cotton fields and sugar plantations of America? Just keep on listening.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone words from home, alone words from
. Then we came to a huge wedding. I had never seen anything like it before, but all I could look at were the strange pale men with their metal sticks. I thought that maybe they were there to help us, but their violent ways and rough language soon told me different. Many days later, when the pale men came to move us from the strange wedding, some of the others looked pleased. I could not be happy, no matter how bad things were in that place, with its heat and dirt and death. I was right to feel bad. I had seen the water when we had arrived and had heard it moving some nights, but I could not imagine it could be so big. They pushed us into wooden boats that I thought were huge until I saw an even larger boat out in the water. I don't know if it was the water or the side of a big boat, but one of my people jumped. I was too weak to try. Some of the pale men laughed, leaving him for a moment before they pulled him from the water. He looked very sick.
I can hardly tell you what happened next. They took my clothes and touched me and looked at me. When I tried to cover myself, they grabbed my wrists. I cried with anger, and they laughed. For 3 days, those same white men watched as I crouched in a corner of that building with barely enough food or water. Others, men who were sick and beaten, sat around me and were told of what we knew. One man thought the white people would eat us. I promised to make them sick if they ate me. Of the fourth day, they opened the gates and we were moved out. I was so glad to be out of there that I willingly walked to one of their boats. It took us to a ship like those I had seen before, and that it is where you find me now.
The worst time of my life was in the despair of that stinking, black, silent hole with hundreds of men and boys. Then a white man picked me. Cassie, my wife, used to say, "I have a proud face. I think it had helped me here." This man looks different to others, cleaner with different, finer clothes. He seems to be a kind of doctor and I don't recognize his methods or tools. careful not to anger him.
The Industrial Revolution was the period when the slave trade reached a peak. Huge numbers of slaves were transported to the cotton fields of America's southern states in order to satisfy the ever-increasing demand for cotton yarn and materials. The conditions in the cotton mills, especially in the north of England, were appalling and were themselves akin to slavery. There was, however, a slight difference between the mill workers in England and the slaves on the cotton plantations. Tony Tibbles, keeper of the Merseyside Maritime Museum in Liverpool, explains.
The conditions in the mills were pretty unpleasant, yes, very noisy, very difficult. But there is a difference, I think, in that although you may be in awful conditions, it's not quite the same as not having any freedoms and being totally belonging, totally dependent on somebody else, having no rights. At least, you know, they did have some rights.
The lack of human rights experienced by the slaves as they travelled to America is described by the people themselves.
And now I'm in the blackness of that huge boat. I didn't imagine that men could make such a place, not even the pale men. My head still hurts. Every muscle aches from crouching in this tiny space, and the metal rings on my ankles and wrists bite into my skin. I'm so scared that my body rebels against everything I eat or drink. A man near to me. I didn't understand his words. He couldn't eat, so the pale men took him out through the hole in the roof. We think they put hot rocks to his mouth. Now his lips are so burnt he cannot speak or eat. I must try to eat.
At first there was much room in the space under the floor, yet we were chained together. We soon found out why. Through the holes in the walls we could see the coasts, and sometimes the ship stopped to collect more people like us. Very soon there was no room to move with so many women and children. Then the land disappeared as we moved in the direction of the setting sun. Then the crying and the heat and the smell got worse. Sometimes we were taken outside to exercise, but there was always white men staring with their guns pointed at us. At night they get noisy and take some women away. The women always return crying. I don't want to imagine what happens to them. Last night there was a storm. I had never been so close to death or so scared, yet I would happily fall to the bottom of this ocean if it would take me away from these white men and what they plan for us. Some of the children were clinging to me. I must try to help them, although they may be better dead as well.
Days have passed and I am grateful to this man. I am in the sunshine. I help him clean and heal the people still in the hole. They have dirty sores under their metal rings, wounds from weeping, and many cannot eat or drink. They get so thin, I think many will die before we see land, even some of the white men. Today, I wish to be in the hole with the other people. White men are demons, and I fear I am less Asante being near them. They spit and kick and whip children and women, sometimes each other. Then, they even threw a newborn baby into the water. I stopped his mother following him, and then we sat and cried.
Tony Tibbles also speaks of the conditions on board the slave ships.
It was pretty awful. The men were separated from the women and children. They were generally shackled. They would have been very closely held together, probably having about 18 inches of space. And, you know, it would be hot and humid. The stench was appalling. I mean, it's said that you could smell a slave ship coming from miles around. And the food was quite poor and monotonous. Basically, things like beans, yams. Water was obviously a very important element, but it was also a situation in which disease easily spread, so that mortality on board these ships was quite high. Certainly in the early days, something like one in five of the enslaved were dying on the voyage. Now, particularly as the 18th century went on, there were some attempts to try and alleviate that situation. And later in the century, certainly on British ships, you had to have a surgeon on board.
When Pope John Paul II went to Senegal in February 1992, he was deeply moved when he visited Gorée, the place from where slaves were collected and dispatched across the ocean.
Oui, en même temps que ma joie, je vous fais part de ma vive émotion. Gorée, symbole de la venue de l'évangile de liberté, et aussi, hélas, le symbole de l'effroyable égarement de ceux qui ont réduit en esclavage des frères et des sœurs auxquels était destiné l'évangile de liberté. Mais en venant à Gorée,
allow me to express my conflicting emotions at visiting this African shrine of black sorrow. It is the emotion that one naturally experiences in a place like this, so profoundly marked by the inconsistencies of the human heart, the scene of an eternal struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil, between grace and sin. Gorée, the symbol of the coming of the gospel of freedom, is also, unfortunately, the symbol of the appalling madness of those who reduced into slavery the brothers and sisters to whom the gospel of freedom was destined. In all truth and humility, this sin of man against man, this sin of man against God, must be confessed.
Convient que soit confessé en toute vérité et humilité ces péchés de l'homme contre l'homme, ces péchés de l'homme contre Dieu, qu'il est long le chemin que la famille humaine doit parcourir avant que ses membres apprennent à se regarder et à se respecter l'image de Dieu. Pour s'aimer enfin en fils et fille du même Père céleste.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone. From home, a long way from my home.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.